From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn how local organizations that support unhoused people plan to offer their services during the RNC. Then we'll learn about an effort to recruit legal observers to attend and document protests next week.
Sometimes just the presence of legal observers can have a de-escalating effect or can deter police misconduct.
Plus, we'll visit the MKE Outdoor-Indoor Exchange to learn about their secondhand business model.
And my thing right now on a whole kind of vision is I'm cleaning up the gear industry. I'm cleaning up the perimeter of the gear industry. There's a lot of overflow. There's a lot of excess. There's a lot of overproduction.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The Republican National Convention is just days away. Next Monday through Thursday, Milwaukee will welcome around 50,000 visitors for the event. But the convention coming to town doesn't stop the day-to-day challenges the city faces, like caring for its unhoused community. It's all hands on deck for local organizations and shelters that will be working to support unhoused people during the convention. Milwaukee County Housing Services is one of them. WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell is joined by Eric Collins-Dyke and his colleague Nick Tomorrow to talk about it. Collins-Dyke starts by explaining how they're preparing for the RNC.
We've worked very collaboratively with the City of Milwaukee and their Continuum of Care, which is the consortium for homeless services agencies here in the community that receive HUD funding. And we've been a part of some work groups for the last 6 to 8 months.
Yeah, probably 9 to 10 months.
And, you know, our charge on our end is to focus on homelessness, mental health, and human trafficking. And the intersection of sort of all those things and trying to find services and spaces to provide, you know, a safety net for folks during that week. And so on our end, specifically around homelessness, we will have an extra outreach presence, essentially from, July 13th to July 20th, sort of that whole week. We will be working to open up a reception center close to the zone for individuals who are experiencing homelessness and need a place to go. We'll work in conjunction with County Behavioral Health Services and their crisis mobile staff. Continuum of Care agencies will also help staff the site and our internal staff as well. And our hope is during that week that we can utilize that site to not only make connections, but again, to provide a space where people can feel safe away from the zone and have a place to rest and potentially hopefully get connected to services that they aren't already connected.
I'll just add, Eric did a great job of prefacing our plans, you know, definitely really large partnership. And I think Eric and I are excited about all the partners that came together in the planning process and, you know, certainly partners that we work with on a regular basis, but we're really trying to utilize this planning process as a, you know, another jump off point for a lot of things that we do together. And as Eric said, you know, it's just a really unique event. And I know you've covered and a lot of media has gone into talking about the security perimeter and the nature of how this event really comes into a city, wherever these conventions are, and it changes life for a week. So I think our focus is really to look at our community and what the needs might be and how they might be accentuated in certain areas during that week and provide that safe place for people to come. And as Eric said, it's really meant to be a reception center where people can be referred to and walk in, and we'll have a triage process. We have an assessment form. We have subject matter experts from all the areas that Eric described. We have multiple people that will be on call. And so we're just trying to staff this very robustly with experts in, again, homeless outreach services, mental health, behavioral health. Again, human, unfortunately, these types of events do bring an uptick in human trafficking and sex trafficking. So we want to make sure we have exceptional resources for people in need during this type of an event.
Is there like an estimate at this point that you all have of how many folks you'll need to service, or is it just like it's happening that day and we're taking what we can?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we've left it open-ended because we're not sure what to anticipate. We're planning for lots of individuals, but it's not guaranteed that they'll necessarily access the service. I think one of our main focuses, specifically for folks on the street in the specific area, is to make sure they're safe, make sure that we're advocating for them in all situations, and making sure that we're sort of there for that service connection if they need it throughout the week. And again, too, for other partners that Nick alluded to in the RNC, that they know there's a resource that they can tap into if they come across a situation where somebody needs a safe place to go, who's on the street or dealing with mental health challenge or experiencing, they're in a trafficking situation. I think, we wanted to make sure we have the space and that we can staff it, and we'll sort of see how it goes.
Yeah. And just really streamlining, like Eric said, for people, how they can get help during that week and be connected. There's a lot of great resources in our city and county. We just want to make sure that we can bring those resources to bear and help people during the event. And again, I think the connections that are made every time we do collaborative efforts like this just help us down the road.
There's going to be a number of police here, right? From, local, out of state, all that. And I know that often with unhoused folks, there is concern, specifically with those who have mental health challenges, with interactions with the police. Is that something that you all are concerned about? And like, how would you navigate that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think we always have a general concern about that, even separate from the RNC, right? It's the folks that we're serving in that space who are dealing with multiple challenges and complexities at any time. And I think that's, what Nick and I are excited about is, the County Behavioral Health Services Crisis Team does amazing work, and they're heavily involved in this plan. Both our crisis mobile team being able to respond to things during that week out in the field, and also helping us staff our reception center and bringing their expertise in that space as well. And I think that is our response, to meet any situation where there might be a mental health challenge and the individual needs a service. They don't need an enforcement intervention. They just need help. Mm-hmm. And so, Lauren Hubbard and her team at the county have been great in planning, and we're very excited that they're involved, because I think they'll be super helpful if things like that arise throughout the week.
In the preparation and leading up to the RNC, were there law enforcement involved in planning with you all at all, like, and other collaborators?
Sure. I mean, yeah, we've had conversations. I mean, we have a really good rapport with the Milwaukee Police Department in terms of, they're very supportive of Housing First and our homeless outreach team and all the outreach teams, and are supportive of sort of the service aspect of a response. Mm-hmm. And so I think, we just sort of carried what we do normally outside a convention into some of the planning for this and our conversations with them. And they've been great about giving us updates on, the security zone, where there might be areas outside it where law enforcement has to stage things. It's helpful for us in our planning as we approach the event in a few weeks.
And I think in many ways, law enforcement and other first responders are going to be one of our best ways of reaching people. Yeah. We're messaging to, again, law enforcement, first responders, EMS. We're going to send out notification to restaurants, hotels. So we're trying to get word out about the reception center and what the resources are and how you access them. But as Eric said, just so many people we work with in law enforcement really understand the work that we're doing and how we're approaching it, and are a big help to us in terms of reaching people and connecting.
Yeah.
Any other concerns that come to you guys as the week approaches?
Yeah, I think, again, to really sort of drill down on a granular level is just making sure that those we're working with on the street who are experiencing homelessness are safe. Mm-hmm. And we're there to advocate for them, whether that's in the field in real time, at this reception center, general advocacy is things happen that week. I think, we always have concerns around the potential move towards the criminalization of homelessness. And so pushing back on that. And I think that's why it's so important that we're putting together these resources, so we have a place that people can go if they're in a difficult situation that week, that we can come to the situation with a resource and be able to provide it in real time. I think it's critically important for us.
And Eric brought up the mobile teams. I mean, so obviously mobile outreach, but the crisis mobile team. So I think we approach it in the same way, that it's all just one team effort, whether people are coming to the reception center or we're just receiving calls and referring a mobile team out to help somebody. So it's kind of trying to meet people where they are for sure.
The late night, early shifts that you all do, is that basically what it's going to look like during the RNC?
Yeah, so we'll have that, and then we'll probably have more shifts just like beyond second shift, so like into the night past 9 o'clock. Some weekend presence that we don't normally have starting the 13th. And I think we'll just have more people out during the day is our plan, especially in the immediate area. We're trying to get some clarification on individuals who are currently sleeping outdoors in the zone and what that means as we get closer to the start. So yeah, it'll be all hands on deck that whole week. To Nick's point, we're hopeful to take some of what we planned for this week and the collaboration and really see if we can carry it past the convention, you know, in terms of looking at different ways to serve in our system and provide housing resources.
That was Eric Collins-Dyke, the Deputy Administrator of Milwaukee County Housing Services, and his colleague Nick Tomorrow with the County Department of Health and Human Services and the Office of Emergency Management. They spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about Milwaukee County Housing Services plans for supporting the unhoused during the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. Now we'll hear from Father Michael Bertram, a Capuchin friar and the director of Capuchin Community Services. They serve people experiencing poverty, hunger, and homelessness at two sites, one of which is within the security zone. Father Mike explains the plans for operations during the week of the convention.
We're trying to work with local law enforcement to get some exact definition of the security boundaries for the Republican convention. What we understand right now is that 9th Street is one of those boundary streets, and that is one of the boundaries of our property. We are on State Street between 9th and 10th, so we bump up immediately to the security zone for the convention. We looked at that to say, well, what happens to our services, especially to the poor? And we made the decision that we really don't want our guests to be eliminated from the meal program that many of them depend upon every night of the week. So we will stay open for our evening meal, 5:15 until 6:30 every evening. But we actually thought about what the convention could do to our guests and to the population of the poor in Central City, Milwaukee. And we decided also to ramp up our services. So we thought mid-July, it could get pretty hot, could get pretty humid. You know, let's open the place up as a cooling center. We've got air conditioning. Let's make sure that our guests are safe, especially if they're used to walking around downtown, which they won't be able to do during the convention. Let's give them a place where they can go and they can be comfortable and enjoy the coolness of air conditioning. And then we went one step further because many of the people that we serve at St. Ben's are homeless. And so we thought, let's open our overnight shelter program once again, because many people will be displaced by the convention. This way, they have a place to stay for the night, again, in some cooler comfort. And so we've received some wonderful responses back from the public to say, that's terrific that you guys are not just staying open, but you're offering your services and even increasing your services for the poor during this week of the convention.
Absolutely. So that's opening the overnight shelter, having a cooling center, and continuing the meal services.
We'll have to be very careful with our guests to really direct them and to say, how do you come here? Because again, if folks are used to being downtown, well, that's not going to be possible. So we want our guests, those who come to us for services, to know exactly how to approach the site. And my sense is, I know that when services are made available to the poor, oh, there's a priority. They will make sure that they've got a way to get to you, even if there is a Republican National Convention going on. So it's a matter of communication on our part. We have to be real clear with our folks. How can you get to us? Because we've got not just the regular services, we've got increased services for you for that week.
And what would that communication look like? Is it just trying to reiterate that message to folks who come in? Or like, how do you keep that messaging in front of folks?
Our main population would be at our evening meal. And so we're going to start making announcements very soon to let people know just how to exactly access us and get to us with the security zones in place for the convention. And so we'll be repeating that nightly because that's the population that will most take advantage of the services, that are familiar with our services. But we're also making it known to other agencies in the city. I got an email just yesterday from Impact, and they said, is it true that you're going to be open that night for shelter during the convention? I said, yes, we are. And so I gave them specifics so that they could communicate to the people that they serve that there will be an added shelter program open specifically during that week. And then we're working with the city and the county too. They're wonderful advocates for us. We have a great relationship with both, and they're really partnering with us to make some of these services available.
So I'm wondering if, you know, you all have any concerns as far as capacity of folks who might utilize services that week. And if was an issue, can you handle it?
I think we can. I mean, we certainly are in communication with other, let's say, shelter services throughout the city. So if need be, we can rely upon them and be in communication with them as to how many beds they have open, let's say if we have overflow. And we're actually familiar with doing that because St. Ben's has a winter shelter program that runs from early December until late March. And so we really work with kind of a consortium of agencies in the city that provide overnight shelter in that at that time of year. We'll rely upon them once again so that we can be in constant communication back and forth to say, all right, if one site is filled, what site still has some more space so that we can send some people there and they can be safe overnight.
Absolutely. And so you talked about the conversations with law enforcement, you know, with specifics around security perimeter, everything. I'm wondering if, you know, you've had any conversations or like anyone on staff has spoken to the folks you serve, like if they have any concerns about law enforcement. And, you know, I ask that because specifically with the unhoused population, right, and those who may have mental health issues, there's concern about the interactions that they would have with police. So I'm wondering if that's come up in any conversation.
We know our folks pretty well. The folk people that come to us are very familiar to us. What I hope that we can do and plan to do yet before the convention begins is have conversations with law enforcement to say, okay, if you run into somebody in this general area of St. Ben, chances are we know them. And we will make ourselves available to intervene for them if that's necessary, you know, to really speak on their behalf. Because if some of the guests really see us, they really value our presence. They know who we are, and they're very familiar with us too. And so I think that that familiarity, that relationship will be helpful if there is any conflict, let's say, with legal authorities.
That was Father Michael Bertram, a Capuchin friar and the director of Capuchin Community Services, speaking with WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell. In about 10 minutes, we'll visit a local shop that considers itself a recyclery first and a gear store second. But first, we'll talk more about RNC preparations and how legal observers and lawyers are getting ready ahead of the convention. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Coalition to March on the RNC told WUWM they're expecting as many as 5,000 protesters on the first day of the convention. Protests and public speaking events are scheduled throughout the RNC. To prepare for interactions between police and demonstrators, dozens of attorneys have volunteered to act as legal observers. If an incident occurs, the legal observer will monitor how it plays out, like what orders the police give and what equipment they use. WUWM's Eddie Morales is joined by Susan Lund, a civil legal aid attorney. She shares how the Milwaukee chapter of the National Lawyers Guild is preparing for the RNC.
I work with the Milwaukee chapter of the National Lawyers Guild sometimes, just as a volunteer. And in preparation for the RNC, I've been working with them and many others to recruit attorneys so that we have a more robust legal referral network for folks who might become involved in Wisconsin's legal punishment systems as a result of their progressive activism this summer.
Can you describe what is the role of a legal observer and about how many observers will attend the RNC?
My work is part of the National Lawyer Guild Mass Defense Program, which has a variety of different things that it does. So it's protester legal support, which connects activists to like a bigger support infrastructure that includes arrest hotlines, jail support teams, community bail funds, legal defense funds, legal observers, and attorney referral networks. I will just say that, you know, my understanding of legal observers is that they are, you know, people who are trained, share the relevant values, and are capable of performing, you know, certain tasks at public events. They are kind of the eyes and ears of the legal team. So they document events that can later be used in, for instance, defense cases or public statements or litigation, which aims to hold law enforcement agencies accountable. And then I'll just also add that sometimes just the presence of legal observers can have a de-escalating effect or can deter police misconduct. You know, the NLG regularly does hold legal observer trainings, and they've been holding a number of them in preparation for the RNC, but I don't know the exact numbers of people who are prepared to observe at the upcoming event.
Can you speak to any of what those training sessions consist of and how that's used to prepare for the event?
Well, I will say for like legal observing, I think the general thrust of it is, you know, you want to be identifiable, right? So the National Lawyers Guild typically wear these bright yellow fluorescent hats that say National Lawyers Guild Legal Observer. You want to have the capability of documenting events, notepads, perhaps recording devices. You get trained in like safety planning and things like that. So there could be situations where perhaps they say we're not sending any less than two or three people out, and they just get trained in certain things to look out for, I think. Like, what are things that might be relevant in court cases? What are things that might be relevant as far as public messaging? What are things that might be relevant as far as future planning for legal observing? But what I've been doing and working with others to do in order to recruit attorneys is we do expect that there could be a number of citations, municipal court citations issued as a result of some of the events coming up. And in municipal court, you're not entitled to an attorney. And so you wouldn't have any representation unless you could afford to hire an attorney to represent you in municipal court. And so what we did, the National Lawyers Guild Milwaukee chapter partnered with the ACLU of Wisconsin, and we did a free CLE training to train a number of attorneys to take these cases, or a refresher on how to take these cases, especially with an eye towards taking cases in Milwaukee Municipal Court, where we would expect the bulk of these to be heard. And so as a result of that, you know, we are building up a referral network of attorneys who are interested in taking some of these cases should citations be issued. And also, although we don't train in criminal defense, or I don't do criminal defense and we didn't train in it, attorneys have expressed interest in doing free or reduced cost criminal defense work as well for some folks who might have criminal charges filed against them. And so basically what that does is it just builds up the referral network for folks who do call and want legal support.
The Coalition to March on the RNC is a group that plans to demonstrate on the first day of the event, and they're disappointed with the city's proposed protest march route, which the coalition says is not within sight and sound of Fiserv Forum. The route that they would like to demonstrate would have them enter the hard perimeter where the Secret Service requires credentials for guests to enter. With this being a possible point of contention between demonstrators and law enforcement, what is it that legal observers will watch for, or what is it that is happening with the preparation for attorneys to kind of anticipate this possible point of contention?
Well, I would say that generally speaking, legal observers might record what happens if the police issue a dispersal order or something like that and say, okay, did they allow people to disperse? Or if there is some sort of clash and arrest, they could record whether there was unlawful use of force. They could basically just document any interactions between police and demonstrators that might later become relevant. I'm not sure as to how they would prepare for this particular disagreement. But yeah, I mostly focus on like if a bunch of those folks did receive citations and people wanted an attorney to assist them in that case, what would be a way to get access to an attorney and what would be some strategies for providing a defense?
What are some ways that people can get involved?
You know, I think a lot of people are concerned about, you know, how the RNC is going to play out and are not sure what to do. And I would encourage folks to get involved with the Milwaukee chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. I would emphasize that you absolutely don't need to be an attorney to do so. Lawyers who are interested in taking citation or criminal cases could certainly reach out to me to be added to the referral list. For people who are interested in getting involved as street medics, you know, to make sure that people are safe in the streets and are not, you know, passing out from heat stroke or, you know, dehydration and things like that, or people who are interested in being legal observers, they could reach out to Shannon Fry, who's the NLG's legal coordinator for both the RNC and the DNC. And finally, I'd encourage people to support Milwaukee Freedom Fund, which is Milwaukee's bail fund. So there are a lot of ways for people to get involved that are helpful and that kind of speak to their particular interests and skills.
That was Susan Lund, a civil legal aid attorney. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. If you have questions about the RNC in Milwaukee, you can fill out our election survey. You can also find an FAQ on the convention at wuwm.com/RNC. Reduce, reuse, repair. Those three words are central to the mission of the MKE Outdoor-Indoor Exchange Shop in Bayview. It specializes in making outdoor gear more affordable and accessible while prioritizing sustainability. They buy, sell, rent, and repair everything from hiking and biking equipment to camping and travel gear. It was founded by John Cameron, who was inspired by other gear exchanges he's seen out of state. Cameron sees his shop as a way to make a circular economy in Milwaukee and beyond. To learn more, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski visited Cameron at the shop.
When were you becoming more aware of the secondhand market and, you know, what made you want to be a part of it yourself as a business owner?
I've always kind of tried to live off the bottom of the world. Like, I don't think that I need to consume much, and I think that I've lived pretty large as far as living off the bottom goes. So I've always kind of tried to live without consuming, and I see that that's growing culturally, so I'm trying to just kind of contribute to it. But I've been a reseller most of my adult life, probably just from, you know, not having much money from whatever job you're doing at the time.
Do you think the view and perspective of buying secondhand, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with thrift stores and that model, right? Mm-hmm. But what you have here is a little something different. Do you think in today's shopping market and changes of perspective that people are becoming more open and willing to participate?
I would say so. I'd say that there's still always going to be a cringe factor to used for whatever reason, you know, for whatever culture of people there are. But, you know, statistically, like, I think that there's a huge margin of people that are happy to, like, not consume, not pollute by using new products, and are tapped into the truth of it and, you know, and where their clothes really come from. So I think there's a lot of truths that people don't know that are the people that are also cringing at it. So.
Yeah, well, there's this concept and a term called embodied energy. Can you explain this and how it shapes your business?
Yeah, so everything I think about in life, I feel like kind of comes back to embodied energy. I think that, like, you know, it took this shirt, 2 boats, 4 factories, like 600 gallons of water, a bunch of pollution and dye out the backside of the factory. It took a cotton field to make it. It took, you know, synthetic fibers to weave it together. All those things and places and the origin of them add up to the embodied energy of the shirt that I'm wearing right now. So if we can alleviate all those processes by just using new or secondhand or repurposing things, those numbers are huge. They're giant.
So pivoting from an inspector in the corporate world to outdoor gear shop, what's your connection to the outdoors? Why did you want to focus on this for your first business venture?
So that's kind of funny, especially framed with the corporate interest first. When I was 15, I met some punk rockers that were riding trains, and I just wanted to be like them, so I did it. And I went to Key West on a one-way ticket, and I've slept in 48 out of the 50 states at least one or more nights doing that. So whether it was by thumb, by boot, or by rail, that's kind of how I got around our country.
So your experience hitchhiking around the country with, I'm sure, whatever gear you could find to now helping people with some proper gear, yeah?
I have definitely tested some gear, a lot of different gear, all the different cook stoves. I've had so many different sleeping pads. I've had failures. I've had things that just lasted way too long that I'm ultimately impressed with, you know, yeah. So I don't share that all the time because it's not a focus of like outdoor hiking kind of health culture, but that is my experience. I slept on the ground a whole ton, a whole bunch.
So your model for this store, you buy, sell, consign, rent, and repair outdoor gear. So I want to break this down a little bit for any listeners who are unfamiliar, specifically about consignment. So I see some price tags around us, and they have certain dates with different pricing. So can you explain how consignment works?
Yeah, so with our system here, we do a 120-day period, and every 30 days, the item drops 10, 25, 50%. And then at the end of that period, it expires. So, you know, that gives it a good run at a few different price points. The focus is always used, but you're going to find a lot of newer tags that are used. So we reach out to brands directly. I'm not going to list them because we're on the radio right now, but directly with brands. And the brands have been really reaching back to my business model and appreciating what I do. And my thing right now on a whole like kind of vision is I'm cleaning up the gear industry. I'm cleaning up the perimeter of the gear industry. There's a lot of overflow. There's a lot of excess. There's a lot of overproduction. And I'm just reaching out and grabbing that overproduction, that stuff that's new with tags, that beautiful, crispy garment, and then bringing it to you at a reduced price. Then we can take it down to even the local vintage hunter that goes out and they go to the thrift store and they dig through everything and then they bring me in garments. And then there's people who just simply are cleaning out their house or are serious athletes and have closets full of stuff. It's endless, the resources.
So remind me when you first opened this business.
August 1st, 2022.
All right. So being in it a little bit, can you talk about your mindset when you first dove in with both feet, you know, changing careers, starting a business? Entrepreneurship is a scary and challenging thing. What was going through your head?
I am a cancer survivor and I could not do my old job. I could not physically do my old job. And then I also was no longer able to have my old job because I had cancer for too long, you know, termination through corporate, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I was crazy. I was absolutely crazy to do this, to start a retail store, and especially a cringy used consignment shop, you know, in a state that's never even had a gear exchange. So they don't even know what I'm doing. It's definitely a little fringe. And I just think that I had faith in people wanting to recycle. And I just think that I had faith it would work. And, you know, I'm still sitting on faith. I'm definitely not sitting on a mountain of cash. So like, I'm looking forward to, I feel the traction right now. I feel the growth. There's a lot of room to grow and there's a lot more products out there that I can continue to get.
Can you talk about some of the challenges or learning curves that stick out to you most? I'm sure there are plenty of examples, but does one story stick out in your brain?
Yeah, overbuying stuff that just doesn't fit. I've bought shopping carts of stuff that doesn't fit the store. And it's, you know what, it's good. Just donate it to the homeless and move on, you know, but that's a lot of money. And also I touched base with Amazon for a minute. That was a total disastrous mistake. That was kind of before I got the business. It raised the money for this business, but then it also took a lot of money out of this business when it crashed. And then, you know, I don't know. I think sometimes it's just hard with people, you know, dealing with the would or would not be people who would want to help you or work with you. And, you know, are their interests in line with yours? That's always a thing because this isn't like a job at the local Target. Like, you need to care if you're going to stick it out here. And so, like, it's good. Yeah, no, things are positive. I just think that, you know, like, it's hard to see what's in front of you until you're standing there 2 years later. And luckily, I'm still standing here. So,
you mentioned you are a cancer survivor. And if you're okay with talking a little more about it, absolutely fine if not. But going through that experience, and I'm sure all of the challenges and the scary moments of going through treatment and coming out the other side, you know, not that it essentially makes you more of a risk taker, but does it help you view things differently in taking chances on yourself and your shop?
I would have never done this. I would have never had the option to take this risk. This isn't going to get me rich in the first year, and I'm already 40 years old, you know. I spent my 401k on this, and that was brave in its own self. It was the only money I had, and it was like the only option. I couldn't work. I still, you know, I still haven't eaten this morning because I can't eat a half a stomach. It's just what it is. So I just kind of power through this stuff and get in what I can. And so this job's pretty much mandatory for me for a little while at least.
What kind of fulfillment does it give you, to have this space and to see your work come to fruition, but being your own boss, being able to work with what's best for you and your life and your needs?
It's really good. It's, you know, I really hope that my daughter and son get to see me be my own boss as they grow. But I've never been good at having a boss, and corporate, I was the square peg for sure. And so the best thing about working here, though, is like you get to come in here with your like goals and your like wants and needs. The thing you save all your money to go do, you're like, I'm going to the Grand Canyon tomorrow, or I'm going to Belize, or I'm going to Guam, or wherever you're going. You've worked really hard to get there. And I get to, like, basically listen to how excited you are, help you with a couple things that are going to help you along the way, high-five you, and then send you on that trip. And that is freaking cool because I get to see the best part of people. You're here to buy something special for, the like, one of the most memorable parts of your life, and that's fulfilling.
On that note, sometimes outdoor stores and the general culture of outdoorsiness, right, can feel exclusive or intimidating for some people who aren't familiar or diving in.
Absolutely.
And, you know, also just not financially intimidating or accessible, but culturally as well. And it can be a little unwelcoming to outsiders, or people might feel reticent to walk into a space they're not normally in. So how are you working to make this space welcoming and accessible?
The only people I make uncomfortable are the elitists. I try to make sure you know if you're a glamper, a camper, an RVer, a hiker, a hobo, I don't care. You're welcome here because, you know, there's only two places. There's outdoors and indoors. And if anyone wants to go and stake claim on it, you know, you can take their white flag and throw it in the river. That is not acceptable. You know, I think a large thing in society is people making up fake barriers to entry. And, there are no barriers to entry besides the front door of your house on the outdoor world. So, like, now let me step back. If you're going to go climbing and you don't know how to climb and you fall and you hurt someone, yo, that's kind of your fault. And there's a lot of things that do deserve a barrier to entry. So let me not be too light on that when it comes to the safety and well-being of our clients and our people out there in the wild doing wild stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, like, if you're not wearing a Patagonia jacket and someone wants to give you guff for not wearing a Patagonia or not wearing a Canadian Goose, that person's the problem. You are definitely not the problem. You're welcome to be here. And, you know, if they were in here acting like that, I would make sure that they feel that same kind of whatever they're doing to people. It's not comfortable. And, you know, it's not theirs to take away from you. So
I also noticed that you often promote other people, other companies, and bringing them in and collaborating. I first met you at the indoor-outdoor gala that you held. So is this part of your personal philosophy or role that you see for yourself as a business owner in the community?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I grew up on punk rock music, and I think one of the words that really stick out over time is unity. And that's a culture that, like, you know, don't die easy is unify people. And so the gala is a good example of, like, what my philosophy is. I invited everyone here for free, even my competitors. The whole point is to provide a better outdoor experience for the people. And so if we gather ourselves together as retailers and guides and everything, and we know each other by first name and we know each other by their family and our friends and our products, then we're going to be a lot better at referring each other and sharing. You know, like my friend just started a business called Forward Outdoor, and I'm really looking forward to watching him blow up because he has got the right mindset. And So supporting people like that, it's a pleasure and it's absolutely free. And, you know, we do a lot of clothing drives and stuff like that. And we only talk about half of the stuff we're donating because we're not trying to milk it at all. But, like, it's strange to me when people don't give back because it's so easy. I'm running this thing on a shoestring budget. I got two kids. I don't sleep. And I still can throw you guys a block party for absolutely nothing.
I like that philosophy. You talked a bit about your biggest joys and takeaways from starting and running Milwaukee Outdoor and Air Exchange. What are your hopes for the long run, or do you take it more short term?
No, this, I want to be old. I want to be in here with big ears and big old hair coming out of my ears, wearing overalls, all having the same kind of attitude. Like, I want my kids in here if they want to be here, and if not, you know, that's what it is. But I hope that this is my last job. You know, if we could blow this thing up and have 3-5 locations, I could eat for the rest of my life on 3-5 locations and everyone else would benefit. You know, we've already brought over last year $60,000 worth of consignment out of basements, attics, and you know, yards, so on. So like, if we're generating that kind of revenue, that's 120 total if you, you know, count my half, out of the basements and yards. So like, if we can do that on a constant, well, I think we're a solution to pollution as far as that kind of stuff goes.
Well, John, I want to thank you for welcoming me here today and for sharing your story. I truly appreciate it.
I'm flattered. Thank you so much for showing up and you know, documenting our journey.
John Cameron is the owner of the MKE Outdoor Indoor Exchange in Bayview. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski at the shop. And you can find pictures and more information at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll explore some of Wisconsin's most unique museums. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Wisconsin is known for a lot of things. It's dairy, it's beer, and it's oddities. The state is home to many unique places, including a wide variety of weird museums. T. Krulos read about some of them for Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins me to share just a few of the unique museums you can find here in Wisconsin. T, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So there are many odd museums in the state of Wisconsin. In fact, a number that could not be included on this list because, you know, you only have so much space on the page, as it were.
Right.
But you have a great list of some interesting museums. I'm going to start with one that really caught my eye. It's also what the list starts with, the National Mustard Museum.
I know. It's a very odd place. I mean, all these places are great because they're so unique. And like you say, Wisconsin is very rich with them. So I had no trouble finding stuff to write about. But yeah, the Mustard Museum is just outside of Madison, and it has over 6,000 mustard bottles and related items. One of the best parts of it, though, is they have a gift shop that is also a tasting room. So you can sample over 100 different types of mustards. So if you love mustards, this is a must stop on your list.
I feel like mustard is one of those things that you go, well, how many kinds of mustard can there be? And then you look in your refrigerator and you go, sure. I have 6 kinds of mustard in this refrigerator.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of the few condiment museums in the country. The other one would be out, Heinz, you know, has a pretty good museum, but... Sure. So if you like ketchup and mustard, that might be your epic road trip there.
So the next one we're going to look at, this is about a history that I think some Wisconsinites are familiar with and then others are surprised to learn about. This is the History Museum at the Castle, and it looks at Houdini.
I know. It's such a great story. And I, like you say, I don't think it's recognized enough. I mean, we have the bronze fawns, which is great, but Houdini was actually an amazing person who spent his formative years living in Appleton first. He lived there for about 4 years, and then they actually lived in Milwaukee for a while before they moved on to New York. So the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton has this great exhibit called AKA Houdini, in which you kind of journey through his life, and they have some really fun interactive displays where you can kind of try out some of his escape tricks and magic tricks. And it's just a really nice recognition of this famous resident of Appleton.
Yeah. Now, the next museum, I think, is going to be very interesting for polka lovers. And when I was thinking about, like, an accordion museum, this is an accordion museum, I wondered what that would look like. And then I went, oh, well, they're a complex instrument.
Yes. Yeah, not surprising that this would be in Wisconsin, way up in Superior, Wisconsin. They have this huge collection of over 2,500 accordions. And like you say, most people associate that with polka, and that's certainly a key part of that genre. But they have accordions from all over the world because they are used in different music styles. And the museum there is really great because it's in an old church, and so they have the museum display. They also have a venue where they, of course, have accordion-centric performances. And they have a repair shop and a really big archive of sheet music and other stuff related to accordions. So it's really an important cultural part of the state.
And that's called a world of accordions,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Well, and speaking of the world, the next museum we'll be looking at, I think some people, again, are going to know bits of this history. A lot of different towns have kind of a circus clown history here in Wisconsin. But this is the International Clown Hall of Fame and Research Center.
Yes. So this location, by the way, has moved around a little bit. I remember back in the day, it was in like the basement level of the Plankinton building, which is also where the WUWM studios were at the time. So you were neighbors with this at one point. And Baraboo has such a rich history of the circus. The Ringling Brothers were from Baraboo, and it became like a circus capital of the country for a while. A lot of circuses had their headquarters there. So it's a good spot for the International Clown Hall of Fame, where they have pictures of famous clowns as well as their rubber noses and giant shoes and costumes and props that they used. Like I noted in this article, might not be a great place for some people to go because some people do have a pretty intense fear of clowns. I don't. I mean, once in a while I find them kind of creepy, but I think I have a normal level of reaction to them.
I will say my arch nemesis is the probably still more famous Joy Powers, who is a clown.
Really?
Joy Powers the clown, yes.
Do you think that she is in the International Clown Hall of Fame?
Look, she might be. She was very well known. Anytime I would Google my name, Joy Powers the clown came up right away.
Oh, that's too funny.
So the final museum that we're going to talk about, this is the Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass. I've heard this is just a beautiful museum.
It is. It is very beautiful. I mean, there's so much glass in it. And then when the light comes through the right way, you know, it's really quite dazzling. And it's home to the largest collection of glass paperweights in the world, which is over 6,000 pieces. So it's a lot of glass. I mean, it does make me, being a bigger guy, it makes me a little nervous in places like this because I'm afraid I'm going to break something. But yeah, very beautiful individual pieces of glasswork there.
Now, of course, like with any list, you couldn't include every museum. But What were some of your favorite museums that didn't make the cut?
Well, one I really wanted to include was the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame in Hayward, which is kind of famous because the museum is shaped like a giant muskie that you can walk into and see fishing artifacts. However, they're only open seasonally, so you can go visit there this summer. But, you know, this being a winter issue, I wanted to include places that people could go out and visit right away. So that was one. And then Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum. I know you've had them on the show before. I wrote about them last year, which is why I didn't include them. But they have a overwhelming collection of cat knickknacks. Again, I was a little nervous because there's so many fragile pieces. But You know, and the good thing about them is it's for a good cause. The money that they raise, they give to cat shelters and stuff like that. Oh, and then last one I think I'll mention, I was just in Lake Geneva. We talked a little bit about that before we went on the air, and I went to the Geneva Lake Museum, which is a cool little museum. I love that they have kind of their own take on, like, streets of old Milwaukee when you first walk in. And they've got a nice little display called The Wizard of Lake Geneva, which is about Dungeons and Dragons, which came from there, and this year is their 50th anniversary. So that was something I just checked out a couple days ago and wasn't on my list, but it is now.
All right. Well, T, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
T. Krulos is a local writer. We spoke earlier this year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how public transportation will be impacted by the RNC. Plus, we'll hear from artists in Milwaukee who feel their work has been censored by some local venues. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWN, Milwaukee's NPR.